This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 113, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com, and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Sir Paul Tucker, former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, to examine the unelected power of regulators, whose power has mushroomed across the economy. As the New City Agenda pointed out in a report recently, the cost of regulation since 2001 of the BOE, PRA, and FSA/FCA has increased sixfold. Seems like mushrooming to me. This is a topic of the utmost constitutional and philosophical importance, as well as at the practical level, one of the key challenges for fintech in the UK today, as we heard last week. Our lives these days are shaped by the likes of Ofcom, Ofgem, ONR, Ofwat, ASA, BBFC, CMA, EHRC, GBGB, ISB, OGA, SHC, SCAA, OOR, CQC, ANHSI, I'm running out of breath, CNHC, GCC, FCA, PSR, PRA, EA, and a whole host of dozens and dozens of regulators. And that's before we mention quangos, which I understand are now called non-departmental public bodies. In the UK, they employ a mere 111,000 people in 2009. Lord Turner, in LFP 065, agreed with respect to financial services with Niall Ferguson's comment that regulation has become the disease for which it purports to be the cure. John Kay, in LFP 055, also felt like I, that in effect this new approach was leading to more crises, not fewer. Apart from does it work, it's the spirit of Magna Carta which set in train the restraint of arbitrary, unquestionable power over us dead when people we have no ability to hire and fire rule our lives in ever greater minute detail. A very practical example of this is that we heard in the last episode with Ryan's overview of the FCA's proposed new rules around P2P. They contain some incredible category errors. Super dangerous equity crowdfunding gets pretty much a free pass, whilst the tighter managed P2P gets draconian treatment. And something that I regard as outrageous and ultra-vile is, in essence, regulating the right of individuals to invest their money as they wish. Or more specifically, these rules don't apply to the rich. So the non-rich will not be able to invest more than 10% of their portfolio in P2P, even if they can put the lot on a horse, or in cryptocurrency, or buy a house they can't afford. So regulation is a huge issue of our time, philosophically, constitutionally. Check out, for example, Hamburger's book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful with Respect to the States? For individual liberty, for fintechs, for folks wishing to put their retirement money in them, or even savings money. I cannot think of a topic which covers such a broad waterfront. It's thus an immensely tough topic, and I've mentioned in the past that I've had my eyes open in recent years for someone to guide us through this labyrinthine maze. It's been a long wait, but worthwhile, as I hope we will soon find, especially if we throw into the mix that what I've not mentioned is that all regulators are by no means the same in the first place. Models vary hugely. Not only does Sir Paul have 34 years' experience at the Bank of England, as well as having had roles on the broader banking stage, he is now a research fellow at Harvard and chairs the Systemic Risk Council, a body set up in 2012 of wise elders such as Paul Volcker, Lord Turner, Jean-Claude Trichet, Paul O'Neill, John Reid, and many, many more who advise current regulators. All of this in itself would be more than sufficient to have clear insights into regulation per se. However, above and beyond all this, Paul has spent several years working on a huge tome called Unelected Power, The Quest for Legitimacy in Central Banking and the Regulatory State, and has thus been thinking super deeply about the topic. The book itself is around 600 pages and has an astonishing 30-page bibliography and is guaranteed to become a reference work in this topic. Paul Volcker says of the book, Paul Tucker has written a most timely and thoughtful analysis of the role of independent agencies in democratic societies. Paul is also not arguing from any position of leave it to the mandarins that cynics might imagine. Both he and his governor, Mervyn King, argued against the Bank of England, for example, being given enhanced powers post-crisis. He has said, too much government power lies in the hands of unelected regulators. And he would have subtitled the book, How Technocracy Should Retreat to Preserve Our System of Government and Its Own Interests. Another comment I warmed to was, policymakers should refrain from participating in many other and broader issues confronting their societies. Which sounds good to me, and one that his former employer, the Bank of England, might have been well advised to follow during the Brexit vote, perhaps. Apart from the accountability issue, there is a practical one. Regulators have an extremely asymmetric risk profile. In essence, there is no cost to them to restraining Gulliver's freedom with one more thread, one more paragraph of regulation. But they run a huge risk if Gulliver goes on a bender and trashes the local village. As I said a couple of decades back to a chap that was one of Paul's predecessors as deputy governor, If ClimeWatch does well, you praise the businesses. If it does badly, you blame me. I'm curious as to when I get the praise. It's the same for regulators. There's little downside for them in the short term in reducing the freedom of the citizens to do what the bloody hell they want. However, when something goes wrong, and it always does, there's hysteria and political calls for public flogging of regulators. What would you do in those circumstances if you worked as a regulator? It's all a tricky thing, and so I'm delighted today to try and dive into this. Let's wrap up this long introduction with a quote from the inside cover of the book. Unelected power lays out the principles needed to ensure that central bankers, technocrats, regulators, and other agents of the administrative state remain stewards of the common good and do not become overmighty citizens. Tucker explores the necessary conditions for delegated but politically insulated power to be legitimate in the eyes of constitutional democracy and the rule of law. Tucker explains how the regulatory state need not be a fourth branch of government, free to steer by its own lights, and how central bankers can emulate the best of judicial self-restraint and become models of dispersed power. Like it or not, unelected power has become a hallmark of modern government. This critically important book shows us how to harness it to the people's purposes. That sounds good. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining me today.
It's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So, that's a mighty long introduction, actually. I've sort of ran out of breath and brain cells after doing that one. So, maybe we'll get back to the simple thing. And one of these things is about how power is dispersed in the world. And there are many theories on YouTube about Illuminati or Bilderberg Group or Soros' funds or all sorts of things. But I think that I actually, in preparing for this, tripped across a fact that listeners may not know, which is that the world, certainly for quite some time, was run from Wolverhampton. And being from Birmingham myself, as you may know, us Birmingham people look down on Wolverhampton, but I didn't really know you were around the world from there. I don't know what Wolverhampton people thought of Birmingham. I'm sure you thought we were wonderful.
So you're saying this because Mervyn King, who was governor of the bank, was from Wolverhampton and went to Wolverhampton Grammar School. I'm from slightly outside Wolverhampton, from a large village, and went to the local high school there. So people shouldn't have fantasies that when I was six, I knew Mervyn as a 16-year-old. When I was 15, I knew Mervyn as a 25-year-old.
You were playing Conkers, and you both decided to take over the Bank of England.
It was, of course, the water in that part of the world that brought us together.
Yes, well, we started with Lord Turner, the first and last head of FSA, roughly, who was from Ipswich. I haven't met many people from Ipswich either. But one thing I didn't understand in that case was that I have one thing in common with Lord King, your former governor, which is that I used to support Aston Villa. I stood at the Holt End and I sort of eventually came to my senses and gave up. But he's continued supporting Aston Villa, which is a strange thing from someone from Wolverhampton who should presumably support Wolves. And I did notice a couple of years ago, he, out of the kindness of his heart, turned up at the board of Aston Villa when sort of Aston Villa was sort of cratering and probably wished that he'd sort of stuck to the terraces himself. So how on earth did he end up supporting Aston Villa?
I have no idea. You should ask him. I support the least rich team that's playing.
Which is?
No, in any match.
Oh, I see.
In any match. The top clubs are all so rich, I find it impossible to care greatly how they do. But being even the marginally poorer side means I tend to be on their side.
Yes, the world has changed remarkably since we were in short trousers playing Conkers. Not that I played Conkers with you and planned all this ahead either. And certainly at the time, I remember that the average footballer for Villa, even the successful ones, would retire and go and run a pub because you made no money playing football.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, you just didn't decide to play football. And at this stage, normally I talk about people's career journey, but you had the kind of career journey in terms of simplicity that quite often in my last 20 years of being independent and doing this, that and the other, I sometimes lust for, although if I'd had it, I probably would have got a little bit bored in that you got a job when you left university and you stayed there.
I stayed there.
For quite a while.
Yeah, I had two spells out. I was seconded to Barings in the mid-80s. I was a corporate financier. And after the 87 crash, I was sent to Hong Kong to help redesign their capital markets, which was a quite extraordinary experience, not least because that was the last time that a major clearinghouse, a central counterparty, went bust. So one of the reasons when I was in office and since, I tend to bang on about important central counterparties are, is because I'm one of the few people left alive who actually was involved in redesigning a system after a central counterparty had failed.
Yes, in looking up something about the origins of Basel lay around the 74 Herstatt crisis.
No, that's absolutely right. The Basel Supervisors Committee was created after the Herstatt crisis.
Which, for the purposes of those people listening who may not have been alive,
was a German bank that failed in the mid-1970s. And as it failed, it had outstanding major kind of big volume of foreign exchange contracts. And one leg had been paid. Deutschmarks had been delivered to Herstatt, and it was due to deliver dollars. And it had closed by the time the new York markets were open. So this is what came to be called daylight credit exposures, which didn't actually get dealt with until about 10, 15 years ago. I don't write about any of these things in my book, by the way.
No. Well, let's go back to the big picture then. It's always interesting going back to roots. I mean, one of the quotes in my never-ending book, I'm very jealous, of course, that you've sort of laid your egg by now and it's sort of hatched as a little chick. I'm sort of feeling very pregnant with an egg, if that's not sort of mixing the metaphors. I've got a very good quote by some academic who've now completely forgotten, who says, origins are obscure. So, for example, as I did, I made the mistake of taking all this advice about what you do managing a small co and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, what is a company? Ooh, I wonder when limited liability started, you know, months later. It's really very tough because you sort of, the more you zoom in, the more fuzzy it gets, a bit like quantum. So, yes, the origins are obscure in terms of the FS regulation. But let's zoom out then. Let's just talk about regulation per se. Let's talk about the sort of the history of regulation. I mean, how far do you want to go back? I'm happy to do it from 900 and fill into whatever year you wish to take over. I'll skip over various centuries, though.
The big change in adult lifetime in Europe is the shift away from a model of state intervention based on public ownership and control to privatization and regulation. So more important in many respects in the development of economic regulation in Europe than financial regulation is the privatization of near monopolies and then the regulation of them as utilities. So this is a world of now Ofgem, Ofwat, Ofcom, and so on. All on the basis that you need to regulate it because they have near monopoly power, and that you can't or shouldn't or wouldn't wisely leave it to ministers to do, because ministers will put more emphasis on the short run rather than on the long run, and in particular will break their promises. Whereas if you're to run a utility company, you need to know that the regime you're regulated under is going to be stable so that you can invest. It's rather like a tax regime. I think there's going to be little taxation of capital, so I do certain things, I make a huge capital profit, and then they decide to tax the capital. But I wouldn't actually have done it in that case. Anticipating that they might change their minds, I invest less in the first place. It's the same with utility regulation. The idea was that you need this at arm's length from government so that infrastructure spending will be higher. I don't want to argue, by the way, that it's worked. I am merely outlining what the motive of introducing the regulation was and at putting it at arm's length from government. Financial regulation was different in that insurance regulation goes back to the 19th century almost everywhere. Banking regulation, the regulation of the safety and soundness of banks in the UK doesn't have a statutory form until the mid-1970s after what was called the secondary banking crisis and came into law because of an EU directive. Before that, it had been done under the informal authority of the Bank of England and in consequence was restricted to big banks, merchant banks, and people that were clustered around the city or big banks out in the country. And in consequence, what happened in the secondary banking crisis in 74, 75, which was a big crisis, was loads of little banks, as we would now call them, that were not treated as banks by the Bank of England, failed, causing a lot of difficulty. And this happened in other parts of Europe at the same time, and the EU put it on a statutory footing. As the years passed, decades passed, until the big crisis that came in 2007, the social purpose of it migrated away from ensuring the system was safe and sound to focusing on whether customers were getting a good service.
Yes, interesting. Well, we'll get on to the sort of the latter stages in FS, and maybe we need to differentiate the types of regulator. I mean, the key thing of our time in the city was the Big Bang, and given 1 second to sort of press a yes or no to sort of save the world with a sort of button and God will judge whether I got it right, I'd say that that was a mistake. Insofar as, well, let's go back to 900. I mentioned 900 because I was very pleased the other day to find a book called Toepark Biblion. I apologise, my ancient Greek pronunciation, which is not what it might be, which was a book from the Byzantine Empire, which if you sort of zoom up to 1985, when I started at Climewatch still, you had things like stockjobbers and you had things like stockbrokers, and they by and large managed themselves. And that system had been in place for 1,000 years. So if you go into the Byzantine Empire, the Toy Park Biblion was basically the governor's manual. And if you were the governor of a city, you would delegate the plumbing to the plumber's guild, and you would delegate the wool to the wool guild, and all that kind of stuff. And it was a book of basically regulatory rules, but it was one book for the whole bloody lot, so you could read it. So that was a system which became tainted and called sort of self-regulation, which is a terrible thing, isn't it? And that was sort of one of the reasons for, as I saw it, for the Big Bang in the city, one of the excuses. And I sort of say excuses because actually in various cases like medicine, the GMC manage doctors still. REBA manages architects. There's various bodies in chartered accountants, but I think the chartered accountants bit, well, accountants in general, but I think you need to be a chartered accountant to be an auditor. So basically we've had a system for thousand years where the state delegated to bodies, to simple bodies, plumbers or electricians or whatever, metaphorically speaking, the market, and they would check how they were doing. And Lloyd's is another example. So that system was roughly in place for 1,000 years. I'm interested to hear what you say about the Bank of England really looking at the regulation from the 70s. And then that was swept away. So we had 1,000 years that was swept away with a little bit of a lag, I think, to regulators, or a little bit of a lag before they sort of grew very big. And certainly, as I recall, in FS, it was a complete confusion of, I don't know, there was SIB, Securities Investments Board, or something, and it had principles, and then that changed to something else, and something else, and something else. And from my side of the fence, there's just another bloody exam to sit every time the regulator changed. So we've got a patchwork quilt, but it isn't. And then, of course, it went into the Bank of England, lost its advisory powers, and we had the... Let's just talk about FS, we can move on to others in a minute.
Yeah.
And then we had the Bank of England, the FSA, and then the sort of shit hits the fan, this 2008, and then people say, oh, no, that didn't work out very well. Hang on, we'll give the PRA back to Bank of England, and we've got the FCA now, and... You know, so it's really kind of work in progress. I mean, if the previous system took sort of 1,000 years and to bed down, I don't think this system is exactly bedded down after a decade or two.
So I think my way of telling the story would be slightly different.
Good, it'd be very boring if it's the same.
I agree with where you end up. So if you go back to the 1980s, I think two things happened. First of all, that the so-called self-regulation worked to the extent that it worked at all. It worked only in established markets that had existed for a long time and had a proper organic existence, and where the community of intermediaries, brokers, dealers, etc., had been stable for a long time. And two things happened. The lifting of exchange controls in 1979-80 meant that a lot of foreign capital re-entered the city. If you like, foreign firms grew in the city. And so the communities were no longer homogenous and informality no longer carried great weight. And there was a series of scandals in the early 80s that arose from that. And that led to a review of regulation. Something else happened at the same time, which was the euro markets had been growing up for a few decades. And they were much bigger than the domestic capital markets, the gilt market and the domestic equity market. And Big Bang, when it came, was in a sense the domestic markets catching up with the international markets that were in London. And that may have been a good thing or a bad thing.
But there was still Glass-Steagall, though. I mean,
there was still Glass-Steagall. Yeah, I'm going to put that on one side for a second. I think people overestimate the effect of Big Bang on the prosperity of the city, because most of the city wasn't doing domestic capital market stuff by the mid-1980s. The big missed opportunity, I think, was that this is when a statutory Securities and Exchange Commission for the UK should have been established. And you mentioned that in the mid-80s, after Big Bang, but in fact it had been planned before Big Bang and separately, the SIB, the Securities Investment Board, was created and lots of self-regulatory organizations. But they were self-regulatory. They didn't have organic roots. They didn't grow out of homogenous communities. And so they were artificial, and yet they weren't statutory bodies, part of government. And London went through another 20-odd years, or another 15 years, without a regulator. Then in 1998, there was an overreaction. We'll have a statutory regulator, and we'll put absolutely everything into it. And whatever one thinks about the lead-up to the financial crisis, I thought at the time and still think that the Financial Services Authority was simply too ambitious. My book is not about being involved in the management of an institution, but it is really hard to build a great institution in the private sector or in the public sector. It is even harder to build a great institution through the merger of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 bodies, which is what the FSA was. I mean, I think during that period, actually, the Bank of England became a much better institution. And I think it was hard. The FSA was responsible for so much and was responding to changing societal demands and was trying to forge one culture out of about 10. And it didn't work.
Just avoidance of confusion. So you said there was an opportunity to do an SEC for the UK in say, 85, which would have been a good potential idea, but you didn't like the FSA. So if we had had an SEC rather than an FSA, I don't know why it's all TLA, three-letter acronyms, but never mind, SEC or FCA. So how would an SEC be sort of basically different from an FSA?
So first of all, it would have been, if they'd done it in the mid-80s, it would have been 15 years earlier than the FSA was created. Secondly, the decision to take banking supervision away from the Bank of England, which in some respects I think was a mistake, but we can come on to that, in 1998, should have been separated from do we want to put it into the FSA. I think they should have had what people in this field call twin peaks, a conduct market regulator, which would have been the SEC as I called it, and a prudential regulator, which might have done banks and insurance. Two big regulators outside the Bank of England, rather than one all singing, all dancing organisation. Vast, responsible for too many things, in my view, to be able to deliver. There's a separate point, and it is separate, about central banking, which is, can you ever take central banks out of banking supervision? And the answer to that, the last quarter of my book is about central banking, and the answer to that is no, you can't take central banks completely out of banking supervision, which is more or less what was tried in this country from 1998 onwards. And the reason for that is the central bank is the lender of last resort. And therefore, whenever there is a financial disaster, the central bank, the Bank of England in this country, is likely to be at the scene of the disaster. And if they don't know anything about banks because they've been kept away from banking, they won't always perform well. So I thought the Labour government did a good job in the way it designed the Bank of England as a monetary policy body. I mean, all of that was done pretty carefully by the incoming Labour government. I mean, people like Ed Balls genuinely had thought about it very carefully. But I think the moving around of the deck chairs on regulation was not well thought through. And if you remember, it wasn't particularly debated. It was just announced. If you've got older listeners, the reason Eddie George, who was then governor of the Bank of England, was so annoyed in 97, 98, wasn't that supervision was being taken away from the Bank of England. He genuinely believed that it needed proper public debate and thought. And one of the themes of my book is don't do these things. Grant power to utility regulators, grant monetary policy independence to the Bank of England, to technocrats insulated from politics, without public debate. Because A, you'll do it better, you'll avoid some mistakes, and B, people will understand what it is you've done. And actually, monetary policy independence was widely debated and extensively for about a decade before that, which I think is one of the reasons it worked. Whereas the regulatory reorganisation had barely been debated at all, and wasn't done well, in my view. That's not with any hindsight. I thought it would look as though it was working in peacetime and wouldn't work in a crisis. I mean, I didn't anticipate at all how badly it would work during a crisis, and it worked badly in the crisis.
Yes, so rewinding from that, I mean, there's clearly a lot in what you say. I mean, slightly fast-forwarding to the conclusion of all this, which is that one way and another, for very different motivations, you say your predecessor Clementi was BT privatisation in sort of the early 80s, which sort of set the whole thing going. And then because that becomes an oligopoly, you need regulators to manage it. Otherwise, all the telecoms companies, rather like what's happening in Virgin Media, actually. I keep getting letters from Virgin Media about three or four per annum saying, we're giving you an even better service, and it's gone up another fiver. They keep putting the bloody price up about six times in 2 years. What choice have I got? Well, Sky or Virgin? That's for another day. So anyway, you've got the problems of an oligopoly. So you've got those regulators. The FS stuff is changing sort of faster than people can quite understand, and having lived through it, that's certainly the case. I still remember looking at a piece of research from Salomons and going over in great detail as to what an interest rate swap was, exchanging a sort of fixed flow for a floating flow. And, I remember the days when sort of clever people sort of sat down and said, God, that's a bit complicated, and how do we price these? And Climate's got a little bit of a problem with pricing those, largely because the courts made the wrong decision and said that local authorities are obviously incompetent and stupid, and therefore it's the bank's fault. But that's a long time ago. So things happen very rapidly, and as you say, monetary policy is a great focus, and people have known it is because it's been around for sort of forever, in a sense. So that was focused on, but actually then suddenly the FS grows. And fast forwarding to where we are today, we've got the better part of 100 regulators all over the place who are growing up very higgledy-piggledy. It's like a sort of town that's just grown up organically. People built something there and built something there with different building standards, different numbers of floors, different things. So actually one way that I take your work, and it's not just the book, I think for people listening, I recommend checking out Paul's talk on YouTube at LSE, for example, there are one or two. Which is that you've spent a lot of time thinking about this from a deep background of decades in this area, and in my words, not yours, you know, we've got some higgledy-piggledy town here, and, you know, we need a prescription for sort of building regs, which apply across the board from Ofgam, gas, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just picking a random example, we'll get back to FS, but a random example that, you know, you made in one of the talks, which was very well made, which is that some of these regulators effectively just have one bloke making the decision.
Yes.
Who nominally reports to a board, but he goes, oh, I think, you know.
This is a big problem with the various utility regulators and Ofcom, in my view. This morning, the day we're recording this, it's reported in some of the newspapers that the head of Ofcom has made an announcement or made a recommendation to government about the regulation of platforms who compete with television companies. And I'm not making an ad feminem point at all, and I'm not making a point about the substance of the recommendation, which may be very sensible. What strikes me is I would prefer Ofcom to be a group of five or seven, where we heard that, I'm making the numbers up, five people voted in favour of this and two voted against, and their reasons were all in public, and they were actually shortly going to be debating it or asked to explain their positions by a select committee. Now, why is it that we have that system for monetary policy in this country, where there's a committee of nine at the Bank of England that vote on interest rates and they go and defend and explain their position? I was sometimes in a minority. And we don't have it in the other independent regulators, including the Financial Conduct Authority. And the way of thinking about this is as follows. So putting monetary policy on one side, what are regulations? Well, they're rules that are legally binding and can be enforced with the coercive power of the state, where the state has monopoly over that coercive power. So actually, laws passed by Parliament.
Exactly, yes.
Laws passed
by
Parliament are regulations to the extent they bind on us as individuals or businesses. But when laws are passed by Parliament, over 600 people vote on them. And of course, it goes through the executive. The executive makes a recommendation, and the executive, in our system of government, the executive typically gets its way. But with amendments being made along the way, and we can all see what's going on. Well, why do we have a completely different process, not just in the numbers of people, but in the plurality versus one person, in regulations that come out of a regulatory body as opposed to regulations that come out of Parliament?
Exactly. So just on that point,
yes.
When I was writing about the history of the company and writing a long chapter on the East India Company, 25,000 words, there was a whole bunch of subchapters on governance issues, and one of which was the difficulty the East India Company had with the monarch. So at the beginning, Queen Elizabeth I signed them a charter for 15 years, and 3 years later, whatever it was, James I turns up and goes, nah, let's do this again. And you go, oh, so right, you've then got to please him. And then, you know, that just went on and on and on, and that's one of the problems with sort of chartered companies.
This is true of the Bank of England, by the way. So the famous story here that your listeners might not be aware of, everyone's heard of the South Sea bubble, and they think about it as the bubble. And the interesting question is, what was the South Sea Company? The South Sea Company was a vehicle for the Tory party to reduce the significance of the Bank of England, which was perceived to be a Whig institution. And the Tory landed interest sponsored the South Sea Company, partly to undermine the Whig Bank of England. And of course, it all went pear-shaped through the bubble, and the Bank of England partly bailed out the South Sea Company. And in consequence, the Bank of England got its charter renewed, and everything has gone completely swimmingly since.
Absolutely. And that was the same time as the Mississippi Company, run by John Law, sort of bankrupted France. And it did so much damage to France in the, whatever we're talking, early 1700s, 1710, 20 or something like that, that France basically said, fuck this, and didn't really do companies for a century because it was such a difficult thing. And funnily enough, going back to how history just keeps being rewritten, there's an article in The Spectator, which I haven't got around to reading yet, reviewing a recent book on John Law, saying actually he was quite a good guy and did quite a good job for the French. So there's always two sides to every coin. So in all this sort of higgledy-piggledy sort of mess, and, you know, I'm very mindful that we're being very friendly here to the rest of the world because 60% of listeners to this show are outside the UK, and they will all have regulators around. They will all face different versions of this problem, different names, different structures, but it will have grown up sort of in higgledy-piggledy fashion. I'm very mindful of some of my Swiss friends who say, oh, yes, we always listen to what you guys do in England or UK, so we didn't have to make the same mistakes after you've made them. So my Swiss people can be thinking in advance. So we've got this very higgledy-piggledy system. And there's two things. There's one thing which I think is terribly important I want to touch on, and then we'll come on to the constitutional stuff, because it's a bit like the law, suddenly comes out of nowhere. And as you say, going back to sort of the centuries of the Bank of England, it does take centuries to produce a culture. I hadn't particularly realised that for quite a long time the bank sort of regulated things using sort of old-fashioned wisdom. But then one of the things about regulation, being either a part of the market, the plumbers regulating themselves or the livery companies or stock jobbers, is that people in a market, particularly if it's a small and simple market, as they all were before Big Bang, know what's going on. They know who to trust. They know who's doing stuff. And actually, I always, from the outside, felt that one of the good things about the Bank of England was not just the interest rates, which obviously you've got to focus on for monetary policy, but was the operations in the gilt market meant that you were in the market that kind of you had an interest in. I mean, forget whether you're formally regulating it or not at the various sort of periods of time, but the Bank of England was in the market. You know, it knew what traders were like. It could hear stuff that way. Now we've got these more distant. Basically, as far as I'm concerned, they're sort of civil servants with sort of less ministerial oversight who are buildings quite a long way away, who don't have any contact with the market, who don't, quote, go drinking in the same pubs in the evening. And this stuff, which may sound trite, but that's been the kind of thing which for 1,000 years have stopped crises before they're going on, which is that someone has a word and said, well, actually, Paul, I don't know whether you heard about X, Y, Z, Mac, da-da-da-da-da. And so the informal input as opposed to sort of request for submission and sort of quarterly papers and this kind of stuff.
I think the times have changed. It's important not to be too close as well. Our society has, and this is true of all advanced democracies, have bigger expectations now. And so there's more process. There's more transparency so people can see what's going on. And there is more process. And the reason for that is in part so that people aren't too close in the jargon. They're not captured by the industry. Famously in the United States, first independent regulator in the United States was the Interstate Commerce Commission. I think it was set up in 1887 and was regarded as a great thing for many decades. But by the 50s and the 60s, it was regarded as completely captured by the industry that it regulated, not serving the public interest at all, but just the bosses and shareholders of the people it was supposed to regulate. And it got closed down, in fact. And there are some people that think there's a cycle to these things, that you start off being useful and then eventually you get captured and you're no longer
useful. And there's a kind of Scylla and Charybdis. I entirely agree that regulatory capture is one disaster, which is the regulator becomes owned by the industry.
Yes.
The other, though, the Charybdis, which I want to say,
is that you don't know
enough. You don't know bugger all. You sit in an office and you get papers sent by email and you make a decision based on the papers rather than actually sort of, you know, meeting the people.
So what this means is that the design of these institutions is tremendously important. Earlier, you read out a long list of regulators, and part of the thesis of the book is that this has grown up in an unprincipled way. That there, basically, we haven't had principles about when should a regulator be completely insulated from day-to-day politics of both Parliament and the Minister, or Congress and the President. When should they be semi-insulated, so they have to go and get their money for their budget approved every year and funded? That's kind of semi-insulated. And when should they actually be at the beck and call of a minister or the beck and call of the president, which are typically, in this country, are called executive agencies? And the surprising, well, perhaps it isn't so surprising, the shocking thing is that there are not clear principles about which of those three buckets regulators should fall into. Somewhat to my surprise, and it's good as you get older to have more of your prejudices stripped away, France had thought about all of this a bit more than some of the
other. Yes, I was rather shocked to come across that, actually.
France have had quite a big debate over the past 10, 15 years.
And what drove that again?
I'm not sure what started it. The high point was that the French Senate, a committee of the French Senate, issued a scathing report about the idea of independent agencies and said, we've got agencies that shouldn't be independent and there's no clear framework for how they should function, etc. The Assembly, the equivalent of our House of Commons, which is more powerful than the Senate, and the executive branch, they then pushed through a law which, amongst many other things, it reduced the number of independent agencies. I think from 25 to 19, but, you know, 25 to 20, basically. That's really interesting. And it did so according to criteria that had been laid out in law by the Parliament. So this was the Parliament of France, the elected politicians, deciding actually to put some structure around their regulatory state. And that strikes me as a good thing. You mentioned earlier non-ministerial departments, and there's non-departmental something else as well.
Non-departmental public bodies.
Yes.
It's a polite word for quangos. Quango sounds rude.
We should find words for this that makes sense to regular people at home. Independent agency means you're independent. And we could come up with other words for in between and not independent at all as well.
And I think the key thing that I want listeners to take away from what you've said, which is that I don't believe anybody listening to this can disagree with the idea that countries need clear criteria as to how to manage these regulations.
Yes.
And regulators, regulation and regulating this whole process. I'm not surprised actually thinking about it without being rude for the first time in my life about the French, insofar as the French have got quite a tradition thinking about how they run their state because of all this sort of revolution stuff and restoration stuff and yada, yada, yada. I think sort of seems to me that the English sort of muddle along one way or another, and the spirit of King Arthur is always slow to awaken. And just before it's a complete bloody disaster, I mean, the Second World War is an example, but there have been many others, we kind of get our act together and start trying to tidy it up. So we're kind of reactive rather than proactive.
But it's not, I'm going to slightly disagree with you in a moment, it's not terribly well ordered or principled in the United States, which had a revolutionary beginning. Germany has another problem, which I won't bore you with. Here, of course, it was very simple for a long time, which is laws are made by Parliament.
Yes.
Or by municipal local authorities. And then, actually, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a huge to-do when what's called secondary legislation was introduced, which was Parliament delegating to ministers, so cabinet ministers, if you like, the ability to pass, to make minor laws. And the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Hewitt, wrote a book and gave explosive speeches saying this was an infringement of people's liberties. The interesting thing is those laws were made by people we'd elected, whereas we haven't elected any of the people that we know. No one elected me,
yeah.
and yet I was involved in making rules. Now, there are solutions to this. One of my prescriptions is that Parliament should give these regulators a very clear objective that we can track. One of the nice things about monetary policy is they're told to achieve an inflation target of 2%. And we can look up and see where is inflation. This morning it was 2.7%, I think. Well, why is it above 2%? And they will have to go out and explain it and say how quickly it will come back to 2%. It's harder to track whether, whatever one thinks about 2% as a target, there is a target. We know how to track whether they're doing what our elected representatives told them to do. With the regulators, it is harder. But actually, for some functions, it could be done. And where I want to say, where you can't set them a clear objective, well, have that closer to under ministerial control. Don't put it at arm's length from politics if you don't actually know what it is you want to achieve.
Absolutely. And in terms of the criteria, which I recommend, I'll put a link in the show notes if they're online on my... give the titles of some of them if they're not. In terms of the criteria, one of the points that you make, which is well made, which is that there are two no-nos, and these no-nos are actually sort of passive in practice. The first of which is don't give vague, woolly objectives.
Yes.
So, for example, going back to the thing that I'm annoyed about the last sort of month, which is how dare the FCA regulate me, an individual, and tell me how much I can put into P2P, assuming that I'm not rich. How dare they? So now they would reply that actually one of the things they're supposed to be doing is protecting the consumer or something like that. But there's no bloody limit to that. I'll give you an example. You know, the road outside my house, my father's a saying about some certain roads is that, you know, you couldn't hit anybody if you tried. There's next to nobody walking around other than the sort of school time or you know, commuting into London time. It's quite a long road. It's quite wide. You can sort of zip down there, no problem. And you can't hit anybody. And the council just made that a 20-mile-an-hour road, which is ridiculous. It's about a quarter mile long. You crawl down it. Well, actually, nobody does crawl down it. Everyone just carries on
But at least you had elected the councillors, and you can go and vote against them.
Well, as Churchill said, the UK, and this applies at local level, is an elected dictatorship, not a democracy. Swiss is a representative democracy, and actually, Croydon Council, which we're caught in just the edge of, sadly, they did have a vote in three of their five sub-boroughs or whatever for this, who voted for 20 miles an hour, but they were urban areas. I'm sort of, you know, not quite rural, but sort of, you know, getting on the edge, and they didn't give us a vote because they knew that we wouldn't vote for it. My point being is that if you are charged with cutting road deaths in Croydon or anywhere else, then all you keep doing is reducing the speed limit. One day it's 1 mile an hour, and you're looking like you've done really well. And the same way with the FCA. The FCA could stop people investing in almost anything other than big products sold by big organisations. And they could, with respect to that, say, we've got consumer protection. Where does it stop? Where do you draw the line?
If you go back to the start of that kind of regulation in the United States, which was in the 1930s, the doctrine was disclosure enforcement is the jargon for it, which is that we, the government, through the Securities and Exchange Commission, will rely on making companies disclose things about their risks and their projects. And actually, the FSA relied on that to a large extent. And then, partly after the crisis, I tell this story in the book, they moved to wanting to regulate products. And I was ex officio, when I was Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, I was ex officio a member of the board of the FSA. And I, and as I recall, one other person said, well, even if the FSA has the power to regulate products, my goodness, this is a massive change in approach, in strategy. It's kind of a fundamental change in approach. Isn't this the kind of decision that you, the executive, should be discussing with the politicians rather than just saying, well, we've got the powers, we've decided to do this in a completely different way? And Adair Turner, who I think you've interviewed on the podcast, was the chairman during that period. And he saw the text on this that I used in my book. And he did actually write to the select committee about it. So we ended up with a halfway house. But there was next to no public debate about it. Whereas I thought that moving, I didn't have a strong view on the substance. I just thought that moving from a regime of disclosure to a regime of regulating individual products was a very big deal. Behind that, and what I think you're getting at, is if a regulator is told to protect consumers, and it needn't be as financial investors, it could be in any field, well, how far?
Exactly.
So if you take the SEC, which is not a completely independent agency in the United States, it has three objectives, which are, broadly speaking, investor protection, efficient markets, and capital formation. And what happens when there is a change of presidency and a change of leadership of the SEC, the emphasis between these three objectives tends to change. And so, relatively speaking, as the Obama presidency gave way to the Trump presidency, the SEC reduced the weight it was giving to investor protection and increased the weight it was giving to capital formation. Now, what I think about that, whatever I feel about the substance of that, what I feel about that in terms of the big issues I'm trying to raise in my book is, well, yeah, I would rather someone who is elected make that choice than someone unelected. I mean, if you sit there as chief executive of any of our regulators, this is not true of the PRA, by the way, which only has one objective, but any of the other regulators who has to trade off one objective against another, or maybe three or maybe four, why do we think it's okay for the unelected technocrat to make the trade-off?
It's because it's a political decision. Do you favour the markets or the companies or the people?
That's a political decision. Yeah. And it shouldn't be taken by technocrats. Now, if you go back to the Bank of England, the Bank of England had not asked to trade off inflation against growth and jobs. Inflation comes first, and that was a choice of the politicians. And there's an annual remit signed by the Chancellor that tells them how to go about this. And that doesn't exist in financial conduct regulation. There's now a strategy steer for some of the other regulators, but in some cases, at least, it's become a kind of long shopping list rather than a proper steer as to what politicians want at the level of objectives. You don't want politicians involved in deciding any of the detail, in my view.
Indeed. But I mean, one of the things we've got here, which is implicit in what you're saying, which is that the degree of independence varies significantly. So I think you said that the FCA is more independent than the Bank of England or the PRA, for example. And, and again, I do want to focus on just the FCA or the BOE. There are the better part of 100 regulators in the UK. And if you did some kind of scatter chart with sort of, I don't know, one dimension showing sort of independence and the other one, something else, that they'd be all over the place and it needs to be a bit more systematic. So one angle we haven't mentioned, but I did mention the Byzantine Empire, so I can talk about Byzantine complexity. And I don't think this is anybody's fault, the politicians or the regulators or the people. I think it's the fact we've got computers, and some days I wish that computers won't catch on and we go back to the nice quiet life we used to have, but maybe they will. So let's go back further. Let's go back to the Code of Hammurabi. Let's go back 5,000 years. The laws in ancient Sumeria were chiselled into a huge block. This kind of a technology had great advantages, which is that it takes a bloody while to chisel. And if someone wants a copy of it, that takes quite a long time too. So you're de facto limited, and therefore you have to be relatively succinct about your rules.
And you have to think carefully about the rules that you want.
Exactly, exactly. Now, these days, in the world of the computer, pressing Control-C, Control-V doesn't take very long. And so one of my other concerns about the permanent state as a whole, the ever-increasing intrusiveness into people's lives. I mean, A.J.P. Taylor said that before the First World War, the average Englishman's contact with the state was a village bobby in the post office. I mean, now the sort of state intrudes all over the place in ever greater detail. We have, for example, going back to the antithesis of Hammurabi's law, GDPR, which apart from the fact we managed to get rid of some spam emails all around, had 20,000 words more than Hamlet. MiFID II, closer to home in FS, had a staggering 17 million words, which is 21 times the length of the Bible. Now, if I was sort of raising the question before that somebody who's there for road safety can keep cutting the speed limit until it's half a mile an hour, because why wouldn't they? And I have no answer. I spoke to some city lawyers about this actually recently in some drinks over the summer. And they said, yes, it's got so bad, Mike. They said that there isn't one of us that understands more than one of these things. So if you understand GDPR and MiFID II, you have to pay for both of us to be in the room, and goodness knows, because actually you can't kind of work it out. It's a bit like a computer code that's got 17 million lines in. Goodness knows how that program's going to run until you run it, and goodness knows what the courts will make it, and all that kind of stuff. So in a world where the cost has gone up sixfold, in a world of regulatory creep in a number of areas, what on earth's going to happen to stop the generation after us or the generation after that having a billion words in a regulation? I mean, it's becoming mad, isn't it?
So this isn't just an EU thing. The two examples you gave from the EU. It's definitely true in the United States. I can't prove this. I suspect it would have been true in the UK if we hadn't been part of the EU over the last 40 years.
Well, mentioning Basel, I still remember Basel 1. They have very simple rules. I can remember them now. Basel 3, give me some time.
I was involved in Basel 1, and it was pretty simple. Now, well, part of what I was going to say is that people are much less inclined to comply with the spirit of rules than they were. And, you know, a part of me wonders whether that was a post-Second World War thing. That the enormity of the shared struggle brought people together in terms of complying with the spirit of the law rather than the letter. That's one thing. The other thing is that, and this is just a thing, I'm not making a judgment about it, things go wrong. Things go wrong at home, things go wrong at work, things go wrong in government. And feels like to me like two decades now here, slightly longer in the United States, the response often is, not only must we learn the lessons, which of course is true, we must pass laws and regulations where this can't happen again. In finance, if I can give you an example in finance, and I think I'm pretty sure I said this when I was in office, the common complaint when you talk to most senior people or people at the centre of firms is it's all far too complicated and we should really get back to the basics. Whenever any particular issue comes up, the very same businesses and sometimes the same people will say, this is too vague, we need certainty. We need more detail in the rule so that we can be certain on which side of the line we are. Now, I think that our societies are navigating deep changes that are social changes and that aren't anything that the regulation might amplify a bit, but more importantly, regulation is a consequence of, which is that there is less tolerance for the exercise of discretion by politicians or bureaucrats, and therefore what people want things pinned down more. When it's not pinned down, they'll go to court and they'll go to the newspapers. And actually, in each individual case that any of us, you know, you and I sitting at home, and we see the case and we think, bloody hell, that's right. If you multiply it over the hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of issues that government can potentially be involved in. You end up with a morass of law. And where my concern is not this particular issue, that's a separate, it's that, and you end up almost inevitably with most of that law being written by people that we didn't elect. And I think, my goodness.
And they're not judges either. We've had for centuries the judges in the UK creating law in terms of precedent.
Yes.
But they're, as you mentioned in your book, metaphorically speaking, that's where the rubber meets the road. They've got barristers there. They don't look as sort of a Wally in front of the barristers. And, you know, they've got judges above them and all that kind of stuff. There's a context which we evolve over centuries to make sure that that kind of common law makes sense and hangs together.
And in this country, typically the judges have been quite restrained, where to the extent that they need to make law, they won't admit they're making law, many of them, to the extent they need to make law to decide a particular case, they'll make the smallest increment to the law that they can to decide that particular case. That's not true in the United States. You know, we shouldn't kid ourselves that we live in a world where judges aren't unelected lawmakers too. They are, and that's a side issue in my book.
Towards the end, you come up with a useful picture for people's mind, which is that historically there was a triangle, legislator, executive, and the law or something.
Yes.
But it's in danger of now becoming a square.
Yes.
And you've got a fourth pillar called regulators, or a bit, yes, sort of haphazard if you're looking at them across the board in terms of how they're constructed and all their powers and independence and da-di-da-di-da-di. And the point you make, which is utterly compelling, which is that, hey, guys and girls, we need to think about this.
Yes.
We need to make it a bit of a stronger pillar. If you want a square, fair enough, but how do we make that a strong pillar?
And that would be, I mean, my preference is for it not to be a fourth pillar, but to be subordinate to the three main branches. The alternative is to have it as a fourth branch. Either way, you need to do this carefully and not just stumble along. I mean, in the United States, people in Congress will regularly, on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, will complain about the regulatory state and blame regulators for this and that. And actually, the solution is them in Congress.
Yes.
And the people that have enabled this are them in Congress. They could pass laws which didn't say, we're establishing agency A, go and fix the problem in this area. They could give them much more precise briefs. But one of the problems is that we've, in the States for over 50 years, in Europe, including Britain, for perhaps 30 years, politicians have discovered that it's quite convenient for them in the short run to shift the decisions to unelected technocrats. In financial services, the famous Dodd-Frank Act, an awful lot of Dodd-Frank, just says to the Federal Reserve and the SEC and the CFTC and the other agencies over there, can you go and fix X? Or could you write us a report on Y? Rather than, here's the policy we would like to lay down.
So in a sense, the politicians are actually behaving as they did to Sir Humphrey, which is, look, I've just been in this office for 6 months. I'll probably be another one in a year's time. Go and fix, I don't know, parking in London or something, or come back with some proposals and I will then decide amongst them. Only that this time Sir Humphrey doesn't come back. Sir Humphrey is supposed to make a decision himself.
Yes, yes. Others have said this to me. It is not like Yes Minister. The thing about Yes Minister, however much we laugh at Sir Humphrey or are aghast at Sir Humphrey is ultimately a creature of the minister and the Prime Minister.
Which is why it's a good show, because there's a dynamic tension.
Yes, because it's the Minister that will have to go and defend it in the House of Commons, in our system. That is not true for the regulators. This means, by the way, that the Select Committee hearings for regulators and for the Bank of England are hugely important for our democracy. Now, if I can make one of the principal points I want to get across in my book is, and this gets neglected, if your listeners go into a bookshop and look at, I'm not suggesting they buy, a book on changes in the Constitution over the past 25 years, and I'm going to make this about Britain, but it's true of elsewhere, they'll find devolution, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, human rights and Europe, shifting the Supreme Court out of the House of Lords, and so on. What you won't find is a chapter on the regulatory state. You typically find one sentence on the Bank of England. It is absolutely amazing, given that most of the laws that apply day to day are no longer passed by people we elect. So many of them are passed by, and we shouldn't refer to them as regulations. We should refer to them as laws, because that's what they are.
Absolutely. Well, I think the point is very well made, and I hope that sort of listeners are around the world can take this away and think about how it applies for them. I mean, there's a number of points in what you're saying. I mean, one of the things that I got from your work, which I hadn't sufficiently spotted, was that going back to asymmetric risk profiles, it is very easy, and there's a certain degree to which politicians can wash their hands of stuff by sort of lobbying it over to a regulator. I'd actually marked a page in the book where you've got a little caricature of how this process works in the States and how it works in the UK. I don't have time to read it out now, but I recommend it to anybody. Actually, if anybody is in a bookshop, it's on page... I've lost it. Never mind. You'll have to read the whole book. But anyway, a caricature, which is basically that if politicians wash their hands of something, they then can blame the Bank of England, the FCA, Ofgem, or something.
It's at the beginning of part three.
Oh, OK, there we go. So actually, it's not just the fact that some regulators, and some are power-crazed bureaucrats who like having sort of more budget. I think the sort of the more sensible ones aren't, and older ones such as the Bank of England know that you can get power for a few decades, but actually won't betide you because it'll come back and bite your bum.
You said at the beginning that Mervyn King and I mean, we did want some more powers. We wanted supervision back. I shouldn't pretend that that's not the case. But we did successfully lent against certain other powers. And we didn't want powers just for the sake of it, because frankly, to put it just at a personal level, I hope we didn't think like this. You know, we were quite powerful enough just doing monetary policy. The problem was we didn't have enough powers in the central bank to keep the banking system stable, and that turned out to be hugely important to the stability of the monetary system as a whole. The idea of cynics and political scientists that every bureaucrat just wants a bigger budget is, of course, it is true sometimes. It is not a universal law. It was not true of the top of the Bank of England during my period there.
It's helpful because the Bank of England has relatively clear objective. I mean, if you're running, I don't know, Home Office or something like that.
Yes.
In the civil service, as far as I understand it, indirectly from a number of my buddies who've been there, of course, every year there's an annual budget round.
Yes.
And it's all about, you know.
But the Home Office is headed by the Home Secretary, who sits in the House of Commons and has a constituency somewhere. The bodies that bother me, and I'm not against them existing, by the way, I just want their remits to be properly framed. And I don't want the decisions to be taken by one person.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a bit of a racket. I mean, isn't it the case in the States, something like, I don't know, it's FS or SEC, I can't remember now. But isn't it the case that they fine, there's some bodies in the States, a long time since I read The Sort of Economist, you know, you're regulating banks, you fine the bank, and then you keep the change, and then you use the money to invest it in making more regulations and fine them more. There's some sort of thing.
I think it's true of some of the state regulators.
State regulator, maybe it's in New York or something like that.
I'm not sure that's true of the federal regulators. I don't get into federalism in my book, just as in the United States, and I don't talk about the civil service when I talk about the UK.
Excellent. Well, I think actually one point you mentioned, again, I mentioned Niall Ferguson, who you thank, I think, near the end of your book as well, which is that in his Reith lecture, as well as saying that regulations become the disease for which it reports to be the cure, he had an interesting point about the law and saying that we're suffering from Napoleon's revenge in terms of the sort of the French prescriptive way of addressing things, and American legalism. And going back to when we were young, more in the centre of this country, actually, I find it very strange, by the way, in London, the way that everyone talks about sort of Birmingham's in the north of England. It's one third of the way to the top of England, and it's one fifth of the way up the entire country to the north, to the top of the UK.
I don't think of it as the north of England at all.
No, nor do I. But my kids think that Watford's the north of England. But there you go. I've sort of let them down. Anyway, a buddy of mine who I was at school with at the time, I can tell the story. I'm sure he won't mind. Happens to be the deputy governor at a panel for takeovers and mergers, and I was talking to him some time ago about this whole principles thing, yada, 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 and the PTM, for those people who don't know, is a relatively old-school regulator, in a sense. They look at sort of mergers, and they do it in a relatively old-fashioned, and I mean that in the most positive sense. They try and avoid being rule-driven. So I was talking to him about this. So, well, you know, we've got a bunch of principles, dada, 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 and we're trying to do the right thing, and he didn't say this. I'm sort of slightly paraphrasing, caricaturing it. And he said, but actually, increasingly, we get requests from sort of lawyers, particularly from America, to say, so, and it's a reasonable request, so when you say this, do you mean?
Yes.
And so he said, what happens is that you clarify your principle, and then they ask for a clarification of that. And he said, what they found is by the time you've clarified your clarification six times, you're talking something that you don't believe in at all.
So we've imported this detail largely from the United States, not from Europe.
And it's a philosophy. It's not right or wrong. It's different ways of doing things.
There's one principle that our legal system has absorbed via Europe from Germany that I think is a good one, which is proportionality, which is do not do more, do not interfere. It's a liberal principle. do not interfere more than you need to achieve the objective that you're pursuing. So, you know, do the smallest amount that will deliver your goal rather than hitting it with a sledgehammer. I say that because that leans in the opposite direction, actually, from, in financial services at least, the approach that increasingly we've taken by osmosis from the United States. Can I say one final thing? Because I think we're getting to the wrap-up. The thing that surprised me most when I thought about this was that if you think about, and again, I'm going to make it from a British-English point of view, if you think about the 17th century and the 18th century, people thought really carefully about the design of government. I mean, even the great philosophers, people like John Locke, he's actually writing about real institutions. It isn't ethereal stuff. Whereas we've allowed, 2.5 centuries on, we've allowed the structure of government to change profoundly. And in some respects, I want to be clear, for the good. I think monetary policy independence is a good thing. I think independent utility regulators can be a good thing. But we've allowed it to happen in many fields in a casual way that doesn't live up at all to, you know, our version of the founding fathers. Locke in France, Montesquieu, who studied Britain. I mean, this idea of separation of powers comes partly from Montesquieu studying our system of government. And you think, God, it's a strange thing that we've become casual about this over those 2 centuries. And I want that to end. I want us to be serious about our form of government.
Yes, I think it's a point that's well made, and I don't believe that anyone can disagree. And hopefully when we get over sort of nightmare things like Brexit, the government can go back to sort of governing and looking at some of these things. And I hear what you say about these sort of great political philosophers, but in terms of, you know, the way I've been looking at it this year, a lot of it, especially when the empire was far away, was reacting to circumstances, and especially with the sort of changes in the charter of the East India Company and all that kind of stuff. And going back to the merger with the Dresdner Bank, we had some cultural awareness thing about a year in, and we were all sort of told that the Germans were sort of pre-planners and would work everything out in advance before doing it, and we were post-planners. I would do it and we'll sort out what you know, I'm sure it'll be fine, we'll sort it all out, which actually led to the sort of nightmare realisation that these two views were actually incompatible. So anyway, I think it's a bit like architecture, you know, a town, a city has grown really rapidly, as London did,
yes.
And it just needs sort of sorting out a bit. Anyway, before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I hope at least at a bare minimum that we've got you all thinking about regulation in your country. I mean, what is the constitutional position about it? Paul has got some excellent recommendations for how we should regularise regulation per se. I mean, who should guard the guards, etc., etc. I think it's really important that people think about this. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT 1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out Capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So wrapping up, normally I ask the guests to throw the breadcrumbs on the water. You're not particularly selling anything as such, Paul, other than the book and the free YouTubes. But I did think it'd be worth just very briefly waving the flag about the Systemic Risk Council, because I actually hadn't heard of them. And I'm a great fan of the Lakota in particular, and sort of a lot of the Native American tribes and traditional societies in general. And traditional societies are based around the elders. Of course, I took a completely different view 30 years ago when I was young. Society should be based around the Young Turks. But now that I'm old and wise slightly, I can see that actually there is some point in that. And we all read in the newspapers the difficulty of politics, the difficulty of how the world's going and all that kind of stuff. And I was very heartened to hear that regulators from all sorts of backgrounds and bankers from all sorts of backgrounds actually get together and try and sort of put their heads together. And I think something you did recently was write about some regulation in the States.
Yes.
Giving your joint
yes.
thoughts to it. I think that's
yes.
terribly helpful.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, chairing the Systemic Risk Council is an extraordinary thing because the group could hardly be more prestigious, frankly. And we hope we are listened to by the central banks and the regulators. And I guess we think we ought to be. And we, part of it is trying to stiffen their backbone occasionally. Part of it is trying to protect them from industry lobbies when they need to be protected from industry lobbies. But anyway, our objective is to help the financial system stay stable. We did what we did, many of us, out of vocation and belief, not just because it was fun or made us important.
Yes, absolutely. And thinking of governance, I think this is something that actually might be an interesting governance of itself. We mentioned Yes Minister, and I've forgotten who it is that Sir Humphrey goes and has a drink within the club, but one of his predecessor's predecessor, but someone to give him sort of an avuncular word and all that kind of stuff. And in the States, I used to look quite a lot at Ray McGovern, who was ex-CIA analyst who rose high enough to give the president's daily intelligence briefing. And he and a bunch of other ex-intelligence people formed something called Veteran Intelligent Professionals for Sanity, who critique some of the intel, how it's used and how it should be used. So I think in terms of this organic world that's sort of evolving, I think there is a place to be played by bodies such as yours or that in combination of helping, critiquing and just having a bit more of a sort of avuncular perspective on it. So I wish you every success in the future, Paul. That's been immensely kind. As I say, literally, this is no joke. I have been waiting years to address this topic, and I hope that we've raised attention and that your proposals get some consideration, or at a minimum, you can start a debate which at some point leads to governments around the world, maybe copying the French, sitting down and going, oh, this is a good point. Do you know what? We haven't thought about that.
Thank you very much. I hope so too.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, a wooden tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.